Yeah, so when I talk about Rings of Ostlers, and I must say, as I was going to use this as a joke later on, but I'll say it right now. I've had a, I'm having in my life right now a detailed study of synchronization and coupled oscillators, because I have twin daughters, and synchronization is really important. And actually, it's quite interesting. If you read, I read all these books, being an academic, I read everything I could find about twins before I had them. And the basic thing they teach you is phase resetting. In all the books, that's not what they call it. But, you know, if one wakes up, you wake the other one up. And you just keep resetting those phases until they get synchronized. So that's been my life for the last 8 months. And so I must apologize. I wanted to do something a little bit more closely related to medical stuff. But this is going to be a more mathematical talk. I tried to take out a lot of the details and just to give you a sense of what's going on here. And what I really want to get the idea out of this is sort of mechanisms for producing bistability, multistability, and interesting patterns of oscillation in networks of rings of oscillators. Okay, so the here's just a very little schematic. So the idea of the model that I'm looking at here, we just have a ring of oscillators, and they're going to be coupled with nearest neighbor coupling. And I'm going to allow time delays in that coupling. That's going to be quite important. So the sort of key parameters in the coupling are going to be tau and beta. Beta will be like the strength of the coupling, or B, sorry, will be the strength of the coupling, and tau will be the time delay. And the elements that I'm going to choose for my little oscillators here, and I'll come back to this, but this is the sort of single element there, is actually going to have a time delay in it as well. So a very simple each little element is just one dimensional, one variable, but because of the time delay, there's a nonlinear delayed negative feedback loop there. The little individual elements can oscillate on their own. And so that's the overall model. It's just based on what's sometimes called a Hopfield neural network or a additive neural network with a special ring structure. Parameters, so very few simple parameters. The delays will be non-negative. The D here is just a decay term, so we want that D to be positive, and then the A and the B can be positive or negative, depending on if you want to think about inhibitory or excitatory feedback and connections. Okay, and as I said, the motivation was to look at some simple models that can provide a variety of stable periodic oscillations and to look at how we can get coexistence, what it is that leads to this. One of the things I wanted, and I'll need to say a little bit about this at the end, is a lot of the stuff, the study here is based on using symmetry. So this system has what's called DN symmetry. It's just a symmetry of a polygon with N fives. And it really doesn't matter too much as far as the theory goes what you put in for your little elements. So the ones, I just happen to have some work done on this kinds of things where I put a little delayed feedback element in there, but you could put other kinds of oscillators in there. And what I expect is you're going to see similar kinds of behavior. So that's work I'd like to do in the future. The kinds of, so I have these H's in here, which are my nonlinearities. So I'm thinking of kinds of activation functions you get in a artificial neural network, so something like a hyperbolic tangent. Sorry, that green marker didn't show up very well. Well, that's a kind of sigmoidal type of nonlinearities. Okay, so I mentioned this already. The single element in our little network is this one-dimensional delayed differential equation. So there's a linear decay term and then this nonlinear delay, think of it as a delayed feedback. And it this is quite a well-studied equation and can have a variety of different behaviors depending on the relative sizes of the parameters. So you can have, I'm just talking about stable behavior, so you could have a stable zero solution or a stable non-trivial equilibrium solution fixed point, or you can have stable oscillations, depending on the values. And what I'm going to focus on actually in these studies is this parameter range. So the little elements on their own, although they're capable of oscillating, they're going to have a parameter regime where they don't normally oscillate, but when we bring them together in a network and we vary the network parameters, and we'll see that we can induce oscillations that way. Okay. Okay, so just to... So this is, and I'm sorry, at the very beginning there I had a number of my colleagues that I've worked on with this. Most recent work is with Yuan Yuan, who's at Memorial University. We've done a couple of sort of case studies, and this is sort of pulling things together for the general case. So that's the little model. The model again. So putting in hyperbolic tangents for the nonlinearities, and you can always have a trivial solution or equilibrium solution. The zero solution always exists. And the way I'm going to get at some of the behavior in the system is many, lots of interesting behavior, but the way to sort of get an idea of understanding of where some of this behavior comes from is to look at bifurcations from this trivial solution. So if you start off just thinking about stability of the trivial solution and when does that trivial solution lose stability, then you can write down, and this looks scary, but it's not scary. You can write down a characteristic equation. So this is like the same as ODEs. You look for solutions of in the forms of exponentials for your delay differential. You linearize around your equilibrium, look for solutions that are in the form of exponentials. And the lambda would be this. So you have e to the lambda t are your solutions. You want to know which values of lambda can give you those kinds of exponential solutions. And what happens in these, even though you have a sort of n-dimensional network, because of the symmetry, you have a nice property to the characteristic equation. You expect that it would involve powers lambda to the n because you've got an n-dimensional system, but it turns out you get products of these terms that are linear in lambda. And for every value of n, you always get a term what I call delta 0 here. It doesn't really matter what exactly it looks like. And delta 0, if you look at, so find a lambda that satisfies that, look at the corresponding solutions for your linearized equation, and those corresponding solutions are in-phasor synchronized solutions. So those are solutions, if you find a lambda that satisfies delta 0 equal to 0, the corresponding solutions for your the linearized system are synchronized. Okay, so this is kind of giving us an idea of where some of our synchronized solutions are coming from. And when you have an even number of elements in the network, you have also a common factor that always occurs, what I call delta k, and those ones correspond, the corresponding solutions are anti-phase solutions. So you're in the in-phase or the synchronized, everybody's doing everything at the same time, and the anti-phase are alternating as you go around the ring, one's up, one's down. So that, and then the other, all these other factors, in fact, they all appear to the power 2, so they're not simple terms, and that's because of the symmetry in the system. And depending on the number of what n is, you'll get different factors in there, and that'll affect the kinds of solutions that you can get. And I'll come back to that a little bit. So what I'm going to do is just say a little bit about stability of the trivial solution, and then these terms, as I mentioned, we get these solutions that come out of these different factors. When we get solutions of one of these factors where lambda has zero real parts, it's going to correspond to a change in, or can correspond to a change in stability of the trivial solution, and those can give rise to our bifurcations. So these, understanding these, how the solutions of these terms work will give us an idea of what the bifurcation curves look like for the system. Anyways, I'll just give a couple of little results. And so the first, this is just a global, so this is kind of a boring result. It tells you that if you have a certain relationship between the parameters, and let me just put up the equation, I can just slide it underneath there, then you get global asymptotic stability of the trivial solution. So that's a boring situation, everything just goes to zero. And it's not really too surprising. What this is just saying is that this decay term d, the size of d, is dominating over the sizes of the strengths of your connections and your feedback. Remember, because of course the hyperbolic tangent is a nice bounded function. So if that decay dominates, everything just goes down to zero. So it's not not surprising result. It takes a little math to prove it, but it's not that surprising. And then the second result, an instability result, so the trivial solution is always unstable if A is positive and bigger than B. That just goes back, if you look at the single element, that corresponds to all the single elements being, if they're separated and you have those parameter values, they go to a non-trivial fixed point. So it's not too surprising when you couple them together, you can't, they're individually, they're not at the trivial solution, they're the trivial solution is unstable, and you can't restabilize it by bringing them together. Okay, so as I mentioned before, the changes of stability when we're interested, which will lead us to think about bifurcations, are going to occur when one of the factors of a characteristic equation has a root with zero real part. And this is just, again, there's a couple of things sort of describing. What we want to do is describe what those, in parameter space, where you can get these roots of the characteristic equation with your imaginary part. And so these are just, give a couple of results. This talks about, what I'm going to do is look at the places where we get roots of the characteristic equation with pure imaginary. And I want to look at them in terms of the parameters. And remember, we had sort of five parameters. So the way I'm going to do it is think of fixing the D, the A, and the tau S. Those are kind of the properties of the individual elements. So suppose they're fixed. And if we can vary the B and tau, we're changing the network properties. What are things going to look like? And so this is just saying something about what those curves look like in the B tau plane. And I think I'll probably just go to a picture because it's easier to look at the pictures. So I want to illustrate, we have, so these are sort of results for general n. I'm going to illustrate them for n is 2 and n is 3. It's a little easier to visualize some things. So when n is equal to 2, so this is in parameter space. This is in B and tau. So tau is the delay on the connections, and B was the strength of the connection. And here I've fixed the D I just take to 1. In fact, you could just always scale that out of the model. And I have my self-delay and my strength of the feedback. So the important thing here is that this A is negative and the magnitude of A is less than D. And the self-delay is small enough that on its own, the elements would not oscillate. So what happens if that self-delay is small enough? If we look at in our parameter space, where are these places where we get roots of the characteristic equation with zero real parts? They lie along either curves. So these are where I have pure imaginary roots or straight lines, and those are where I have zero roots. And in the case of when n is equal to 2, the characteristic equation just had two factors. One corresponded to synchronized or in-phase solutions, and one to anti-phase solutions, and you just get, in the case of the pure imaginary roots, you have this sort of alternation. So these solid lines are where I have in-phase, corresponding in-phase solution, and those correspond to anti-phase solution. The trivial solution is stable in here, and as I move out, I'm going to lose stability, and as I cross these lines, the trivial solution gets more and more unstable. If the self-delay is small enough, then we get sort of a simple picture like that. You have this region of stability in the middle, and then you lose stability when you go out. If the self-delay gets a little bit bigger, then things get a little more interesting, and the curves become non-monotone, and you get crossings of the line by the curve, and so my region of stability shrinks a little bit, and the boundary of it is now made up of pieces of different curves there. So the big difference between, as I mentioned here, the magnitude of A is less than D. In this case, we had that global stability result that I mentioned. So there should be a region in parameter space where for any values of tau and tau s, I always get stability. So you can see this in the pictures. No matter how big you make tau s, all these curves here where I have pure imaginary eigenvalues can never penetrate into the axis. So you have a little strip in here, and you can show exactly what that strip is, where there's always stability of the trivial solution, and that's a global. It's the only thing that's occurring. When A becomes bigger than D in magnitude, and I'm just going to show the picture for n is equal to 3 just for variety, then it's a little bit different. You've got this is the same thing. All I've done is taking the A is bigger than D in magnitude. Now you've got, again, the solid lines are corresponding to synchronized solutions. The dotted ones are now corresponding to the solutions, the other factor in the characteristic equation. In this case, it'll be a little more complicated pattern. We'll talk about that later. The delay is small enough, you still have a region where you have stability. But if the delay gets bigger, the curves come in and eventually you have a reach, you get to a point. First, I mean, it's very complicated. There's no the only point here is there's no stability region. So you, if the, you increase the self-delay enough, then the trivial solution loses stability. And again, if you go back, it's not too surprising because it, when you've increased it enough, then little elements on their own are oscillating, and now you're coupling together things that are oscillating. And what you're seeing is, again, by coupling together, you can't sort of restabilize things. Okay, so that's sort of the idea of the stability. What about the bifurcation? So as I mentioned, those lines where I have which those pictures I just showed would tell you about the stability regions also tell you about the bifurcations. Those places where I have zero roots of the characteristic equation are going to correspond to, when I look at the nonlinear equation, they're going to correspond to bifurcation curves. The straight lines where I had zero roots, you have steady state bifurcations. In the kind of nonlinearity I chose, that corresponds to pitchfork bifurcations. You can determine whether they're subcritical or supercritical. It just depends on relative values of the parameters. The solid lines, those were where we had the synchronous, corresponded to synchronous solutions. Those are going to give rise to synchronous hop bifurcations, so giving rise to periodic solutions where everything's doing the same thing. And when n is even, we had these, we'll have get this possibility of hop bifurcation to antiphase oscillations. And then when we have higher order n, you have these other terms in the characteristic equation, that things that look like that, and we'll get other Hopf bifurcations that correspond to different oscillatory patterns. So I'll just and what you using equivalent bifurcation theory, you can predict for each n what the kinds of patterns are that you expect to see. Okay, and so I just want to we'll go through just as I said, the n is 2 and n is 3 case to kind of look at what we can see in the system. Okay, so this will fit on. This is sort of restating it, but just for the n is 2 case, and I've just picked one particular set of parameter values. So what we're seeing here, again, we have stability, and then depending on where we lose stability, if we cross one of these dotted or dashed lines, we're going to give rise to an antiphase oscillation, and if we cross where we have a solid line, we're going to give rise to in-phase oscillations. And so you can see as I increase the delay, if I go up here, I can kind of go through a change from antiphase to in-phase and sort of alternate with different kinds of oscillations. And we can see this. So in this case, B is positive. That corresponds to just excitatory connections. And B is over here is negative, corresponds to inhibitory connections. So it doesn't really matter whether the connections are inhibitory or excitatory. We can see the in-phase and the antiphase in both cases. And in the and I just wanted to give you an example of kind of what you see in the more complicated. So when n is equal to 3, when you have those symmetric Hopf bifurcations, the equivariant Hopf bifurcation theory tells you that instead of like a standard Hopf bifurcation, you get one family of periodic orbits that arises when you have the bifurcation. In the symmetric case, remember we had you get these double eigenvalues, and you end up in this case you get I think it's 8 branches of periodic orbits coming from a single Hopf bifurcation. There's 3 types. You just get, if I get this right, there's 3 of this type, 3 of that type, and 2 of that type. But they all, so they all come out at the same time. What you don't get out of the theory is which ones are stable, so we're going to do that by doing some numerics. But because of the symmetry, we can get all these different sort of patterns of oscillation coming out. And so just to illustrate in this case, when n is 3, so the idea again here, along these, if I lose stability along here, I'm going to get my synchronous Hopf bifurcation. Just everybody's oscillating, doing the same thing. And then when I cross here, I'm going to get this symmetric Hopf bifurcation. So I'm going to get some kind of pattern of oscillation. There's these 8 different branches, 3 different types of oscillation. We need to do numerics to figure out which one is stable, which one we might actually observe. But the interesting thing is because these guys are forming the boundary of the stability region, you can see either one just depending on what the value of the tau is. Okay, and then the just to get back to something that Jacques mentioned this morning, and and you could actually see in that last picture, is that we actually have mode interactions here. So we have places where, and I'll just point it out here, these curves cross. So as I mentioned here, when I cross here, I'm going to get a synchronous Hopf bifurcation, and here I'm going to get that equivariant Hopf bifurcation. If I cross through here where the two points cross, then I have both of them happening at the same time. So what you may expect here is that we could get some kind of coexistence of the limit cycles from this Hopf bifurcation and whatever stable thing we get from this one. All right, and in fact, that's what we observe. So maybe I'll just show you that, and then I'll come back and so this is just showing in the case n is equal to 3, in the sort of phase space x1, x2, x3, we can see two different oscillations. One is occurring on the line x1 is equal to x2 is x equal to x3, so the actual solution is going back and forth on that line, so it's just perfectly, everybody's in phase. And then you have another one here, where they're not synchronous, so this is just your in phase or synchronous solution, just a time history. The other one, there's actually two of them. I call this phase locked, so they're doing the same thing but not at the same time. So the oscillation is sort of going around the ring. And there's two of those, just depending on which one sort of leads the other one. When you do it in the phase portrait, they all look the same. So in that case, we had sort of two different stable patterns that we can see. There's also other some symmetric Hopf bifurcation. There's other possible solutions. They don't appear to be stable. So I mentioned there were three different types. You can sort of trick the system into seeing them. So the other kinds of solutions you can see are what are called, some people call mirror reflecting. So two of the three are doing the same thing and the other one's doing something different. So if you start with solutions where you start initial conditions where two of the elements are doing the same thing, then there's some kind of subspace there, invariant subspace. So you kind of stay on that. It's not stable. So if you start away from that, you don't see the solutions. But if you start with these two of them exactly the same, then you end up with two doing exactly the same thing and the other one doing its own thing. And there's three different versions of these, depending on which two you start the same. So you can see these other oscillations that were created by this equivariant Hopf bifurcation. They're just not stable to arbitrary initial conditions. Okay, and just so that was the n is 3. I just want to illustrate the n is equal to 2 case is kind of interesting too. So again, you have these places where you have the interaction of the two Hopf bifurcations, and you can have interaction of a Hopf bifurcation and a pitchfork bifurcation. So you get, for instance, in this case I have coexistence. You have a pair of fixed points here. So I'm using three different initial conditions, all the same parameter values. Two of them go to these equilibrium points. So and these ones, U1 is equal to minus U2. And then the other one goes to this synchronous oscillation, and if you just switch the sign of B, then you get the opposite thing. That's just so you go to sort of synchronous equilibria and anti-synchronous oscillations, and you can also get coexistence of the in-phase and anti-phase oscillations for the same parameter values, just change the initial conditions. Okay, so I think just to where's Siv? A little few more time. Okay, I just want to say a word about this. So this is done all with everything perfectly symmetric. Everybody's identical. I want to say just a little bit about what happens if things aren't identical. Because obviously in reality, you wouldn't expect everything to be exactly the same. So how much can we say? I mean, the theory is for perfectly identical elements. So this is work in progress. I have to do more, but we've done a little bit on the case when n is equal to 2, which is actually a little bit easier than the other more general case. So this is n is equal to 2 and everything's identical. That's just to remind you what the model looks like. So then if we take non-identical, so now we just allow everything to be different, so all the parameter values there. The nice thing, it turns out, is that this model still is amenable to some analysis, and you can look at things, and I won't go through any details here, but just to highlight, you can look at, take tau to be sort of the average of tau 1 and tau 2. So the old, in the symmetric cases, these would have both been the same, and they would have been tau. So now I'll take tau to be their average. And in the old symmetric model, I had b's here, and now I'm just going to take beta to be the product. So it's sort of like b squared. And what you can, if you look at sort of those bifurcation pictures in the same kind of parameter space as now I've got tau and beta instead of tau and b, you see the same kinds of pictures when the parameters are close. So I've just left the d's, now are both 1. In fact, I'm keeping the tau's the same. These are the self-delays. And I've just made a small difference between these are the strength of the self-feedback. But you still see the same kind of picture. You've got these curves where you have pure imaginary eigenvalues of hop bifurcations, you have interactions, you have pitchfork bifurcation. And the interesting thing is when you look near these interaction points, the mode interactions, for instance here, we have this, we expect to see some kind of oscillation coexisting with some kind of equilibrium point, and we get to see something which is very suggestive of what we saw in the symmetric one. So we have an oscillation that's not exactly in phase, but it's quite close to being in phase, coexisting with a pair of equilibria that are quite close to u1 is equal to minus u2. So we sort of preserve that structure even though we've lost the symmetry. And we see the same thing with the oscillations. You can find places where you have coexistence of two periodic solutions, stable periodic solutions. One's almost in phase, one's almost anti-phase. So when we lose, when we perturb from the symmetry, we still kind of kept the structure. So this is something that needs a little bit more work to do in a more general case, but it's nice that we still see it in the cases n is equal to 2. So I think I'll just finish up. So just some conclusions. So we saw these different oscillation times. We can predict these using equivariant bifurcation theory. This is just sort of to go through and actually show we could actually see them. And actually, the kind of stuff that's not done by the equivariant bifurcation theory is, as I mentioned, predicting all the stability. So what we see, a very important thing with this, when we have these multiple time delays in the mode interactions, is that you have all these bifurcation patterns, but you can get all of them being, or parts of them being on the stability region, of the boundary of the stability region, so they're actually giving rise to stable oscillations, so they're actually patterns that you can see. And we have seen some persistence when we break the symmetry. That's something I want to look at more in the future if you have more larger networks. And as I mentioned at the very beginning, the equivariant bifurcation theory doesn't really care what kind of oscillator you put in your system. So one thing we'd like to look at is put in like a more biophysically motivated equation for our neuron, and we should get, especially if you put in something that could burst or something like that, you get obviously get more interesting behavior, but you could still see these kinds of patterns. And I'll just leave it there. Thank you.